This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week we are going to speak with someone who is over in the UK, Dr. Richard Wiseman. Professor Wiseman actually is professor of public understanding of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire, and he has studied psychology of the paranormal. In fact, one of my favorite books on my library shelf is Paranormality, which you can order through Amazon if you'll click the link that's on the Magic Word Podcast website here this week. But anyhow, he talks about that and many other things. His first book, I believe, is called The Luck Factor, and then I think Psychology in 59 Seconds. Anyhow, he's had a series of award-winning books that have done very well. And in fact, he's got a new book out, which we're going to be talking about, which is entitled Magic Your Mind Happy. He also is the host, or I should say a co-host, of his podcast that's called Richard Wiseman's On Your Mind. And also, he has, I shouldn't forget about the Quirkology over on YouTube, where he has over 800 million views of his videos. There have been some incredible things. He's appeared at Magic Live a couple of times, and at Blackpool, he has worked with Andy Nyman and Darren Brown, and just has a great background in magic, and in particular, seances and things we think we see, the paranormal. By the way, I mentioned the new book that he has out, Magic Your Mind Happy, and he has agreed to give out a couple of copies, signed copies, to a couple of lucky listeners. We'll talk about the contest at the end of this podcast. Also, one other thing I do want to mention is I have just recently added a new component of the Magic Word Podcast, and I call it the Magic Whisper. The reason is these are things that are kind of talked about, but not really talked out loud or in general public necessarily all the time, but they are topics that I have heard or I thought you'd be interested in hearing. Also, it's kind of behind the scenes, information about some upcoming conventions, also letting you know who's coming up next week, and if possible, I'll even give you a few sound bites. It's, again, a video component, which will be over on YouTube. So if you'll just go and check that out, and you can find that by just doing a search for Scott Wells or Texas Magician, and you can find that. And it is just a short video. It'll be coming out on Tuesdays, and it'll be just about 10 minutes or less, just to kind of, again, be an overview of what's happening. I'm just trying to get some listener feedback. So if I get some suggestions from you on how to improve this podcast, things you like or don't like, and also if you'd like to have a shout out, that's the place where I'll be doing it. Anyhow, more information over there. But let's get going with this week's episode. Please welcome my guest, Professor Richard Wiseman, here on The Magic Word. I've got with me today someone who is a noted psychologist and has gotten his undergraduate degree from the University College in London, and then went on to the University of Edinburgh, where he got his PhD then in psychology. It was interesting. He's been a magician for such a long time. Back, I guess, even was working at Covent Garden. I was listening to his podcast about that, and he said he wasn't that good, which is why he decided to go to college, I guess. But we'll discuss that. It's very, when you're in Covent Garden, if you don't get an audience, I mean, people are going to move on. Anyhow, he is someone perhaps you have seen, you have heard. I have admired him from a distance for so many years on so many different levels. If you've been to Magic Live, he has been a presenter for a couple of years. In one particular year, he did a really cool seance in which he had people go over to another room and the rest of us were watching on the big screen. And another time, we were all going into a room, had a few different groups that came in, and we were pushing buttons and answering these questions. And it was a lot of fun. If you had not attended Magic Live, perhaps you might be one of the people who have viewed over 800 million times one of his Quirkology videos that's on YouTube. Perhaps you have read one of his books, as I'm a huge fan of one in particular called Paranormality, in which he has done a lot of research about seeing things that are not there. And he's done some work with seances with Andy Nyman. And I had Andy on before. You might go back and listen to a podcast on that. So if you're ready to get going, I'd suggest that you go get yourself some Earl Grey and have tea time with Richard Wiseman. Here he is, Dr. Richard Wiseman. Wiseman. Hi there, Professor.
Hello. Pleasure to be here, and greetings from Edinburgh. A slightly cloudy Edinburgh. It's sunny this morning, which means that it's declared a national holiday in Scotland if the sun comes out.
it's not Greek. Right.
Indeed. And we should be clear, when you're being almost too kind when you said the Covent Garden thing was not so great. It was a disaster. We were awful. We were beyond awful. I went down there the other day. They're still booing us, even though it was about 40 years ago. That is how bad it was.
There has to be a baseline, right?
Yes, and Covent Garden is very much my baseline. Yes, anything is better than that. In one person, it just smiling on the off chance is better than the response we got from Covent Garden. So, yes, that was many years ago, but thank goodness moved on and upwards, which you know, it has to be statistically. So, yeah.
Now, you are currently a professor of psychology and at the University of Hertfordshire, and I am a big fan. Terry Seabrook was a longtime friend, and I went to visit him in Hertz. And I know he was a big fan then also of the football club there in town. Mm. And some fact, somewhere around here, I've still got a scarf that says Hertz on it. And so I followed that for a while. As I recall, I think Elton John owned or still owns the team. Is that right? Or did you know that? Or
I think that could be right. Yeah, I'm not a football expert, which is a way of saying I know absolutely nothing about it.
Well, you and I are on the same level, my friend. So.
And many magicians. I mean, a sport doesn't really feature on the radar of magic very much in my experience. But no, Hertfordshire has always been very kind to me, supported all the kind of weird and wonderful projects that I've been involved in. And you really need that as an academic. You know, lots of universities just wouldn't want somebody looking at paranormal stuff or magic-y stuff or anything like that. So, no, it's been a wonderful 30 years now I've been at the university.
You know, you touched on something there that's interesting, that a lot of magicians necessarily are interested in sports. And perhaps it's because that a lot of magicians were not athletes, and that's why they went into magic, because they could not be on the team. And so they decided, I can kind of fool people and make friends this way. And so that's kind of a commonality I can see, because I've talked to so many people. It's like the last thing we would ever talk about at a magic convention or in a session or something would be sports. If you bring it up, most people just kind of glaze over. It's just not something that they discuss.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I suppose there's all sorts of things going on there. I mean, magic is certainly a wonderful way of getting attention in a social environment, because you've got your little trick, you know what's going to happen, and you sort of your pattern, so on. Also, it tends not to involve team playing very, very much. You know, it is a solid thing you rehearse, and then normally it's one-on-one or one on a small group. So yeah, magicians are not team players particularly, and they're not when it comes to creating theatre. You're having worked on a few plays and putting magic into place, you realize that a play really is a team effort. You know, you've got a lighting designer, a sound person, and actors and directors and choreographers, where magicians are one man and one person bands. And sometimes that's good, because it means they're very agile and can change things around just before they walk on stage. And other times it's not so good, because they're not getting that diversity of input. So it's a double-edged sword, I think.
And another thing I think I see as a common thread, and again, Terry Seabrook and I used to talk about this for hours, and that is Sherlock Holmes. And I think that's because of the deductive reasoning that Sherlock Holmes has, that he likes the psychology of, and I think magicians enjoy this as well.
I think they do. I mean, of course, created by Arthur Conan Doyle, who is a huge believer in the paranormal. That was the irony. I mean, massive spread.
True.
And a believer in fairies as well. He defended the existence of fairies. And I think part of what was going on there, I mean, if you look at what Sherlock Holmes is doing, it is actually impossible, as we all know. You know, you can't glance at somebody's body language and know what card they're thinking of. That is a kind of fantasy. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, I think it fits in with Arthur Conan Doyle's kind of fantasy world, rather than what's actually going on in the real world in terms of body language, which is normally you can't tell anything at all from the way someone's standing or walking or whatever. But it is a curious one.
That's an interesting thread right there then too, Richard, because I have read some books. It was Joe Notaro, I think, had written a book about what the body says. He was an FBI profiler, I believe, or something, and talking about the importance of whether that you're mirroring somebody and how to, this kind of a thing. Do you give much credibility to body language?
I mean, some of it's kind of obvious, I guess, in some ways, but not very much. It's an unreliable source because it's a fairly controllable one. Mm. You know, whether I move my hands around or cross my arms, it's something I can control. So most of my work into that sort of thing has been into lying and has looked far more at the words people use and how they use them. And of course, magicians can kid themselves about this, that they actually do have some insight into body language. But, you know, I would say if you've got no idea what the card is, or ask someone to think of a card, you genuinely got no idea what it is, try and figure it out from their body language and see how far you get. I'd look forward to hearing the results of that experiment.
Yeah, I was just thinking about there was one particular thing, I believe, that was the Nixon and Kennedy debate back in the early 60s, in which that Nixon was just blinking many times and everybody felt like he was unreliable and perhaps wasn't telling the truth.
Well, this blinking is really interesting. I've actually done some work on magic and blinking, because blinking is a visual reset. So when we're looking at a visual scene, it's a vast amount of information coming in. And blinking is literally downtime when the brain is kind of resetting. And so if you watch an audience watching a film, they tend to blink at the same time because they're predicting when there won't be anything interesting happening on screen. Maybe it'll be a cut or something like that. And the same happens with magic. We looked at people watching Teller perform his amazing Miser's Dream routine, which ends with the goldfish. And on each of the steals, they tended to coincide with members of the audience blinking. Because they're done on the offbeat. They're done on a laugh or people are seeing an effect and another part of the routine and so on. And so, yeah, blinking is kind of an interesting one from a magic point of view. But again, you know, it's not going to be 100%. And as we know, you know, for magic, it needs to be bombproof. You need to be able to stand in front of a group of strangers and this trick works every time. That's why magicians are better psychologists than psychologists. When I do an experiment, I'm lucky if it works on 50, 60% of my participants. With a magic trick, it has to work on everyone pretty much under all circumstances.
That's right.
So it is phenomenal psychologically what magicians do.
On the flip side of that, you're talking about the audiences blinking. When I have seen magicians blink, it's like, oh, that's where he did the move.
Yeah. And there's a bit of kidding yourself about that. And there's been some research into that. Yes. I think it's better not to blink at all as a performer and just stare relentlessly at your audience. It doesn't come across at all creepy.
Yeah, make them very uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable. Yeah. Even more uncomfortable if such a thing were possible. Yes.
Exactly. Oh, one of the things as far as for your CV, I was going to say at the beginning over here, of course, that you are the host of On My Mind podcast, which I guess you got about 100 and some podcasts on that. That's a delightful podcast. And it is one of the leading podcasts in the world. It's only, what, about 20 minutes or 25 or so. So it's a nice chunk of time.
Thank you. Yes, they were lots of fun to do with Marnie Chesterton, was my co-host. And
he has such a lovely voice.
Lovely, lovely person. And the strange thing was, even though there's a nice kind of chemistry there, we don't know each other at all. So we meet for the episode, we do the episode, and we go our separate ways. So it was lovely to just sort of have that kind of special time. But it's not like I've known her for years or anything. It just sort of feels very comfortable. So, yeah, thank you for your kind words there.
Yeah, no, you have fooled me there because it seemed like you guys probably get together for coffee every morning. It's kind of what it felt like, you know, just two friends talking.
Yeah, people say that, but no, absolutely not. No idea. No idea who she is. Complete mystery.
That's interesting. Going back over to the book on paranormality, I think is an amazing book. And again, I have read it several times. And there was one particular thing I wanted to talk with you a little bit about. And that was, I guess, an apparition of what you had created and going to a bar in a dockside someplace and saying, okay, well, did this Captain Jack actually die here? And did he get his eye poked out and got a peg leg or whatever? And then the story grew, I guess, basically. From that. Can you give a quicker summary than that?
Yeah, that's actually not my work. So that was, it's in the book, but it's somebody else's experiment, I think carried out at the end of the 70s. And it was a great idea, which was to look at the way in which ghost stories change over time and affect testimony. And of course, magicians know this as well. You know, that if you do a trick for somebody, really socially, there's two things going on. There's their experience of that, but then what you're giving them is some social currency. You're giving them an experience to tell other people about. If they go to the other person and went, oh, it's amazing. Yeah, the magician put somebody in a box, saw them in half. And the other person goes, well, was there two people in the box? Well, next time they tell that story, they're going to say there was just one person in that box. We saw inside the box and then the magician saw the person in half. In other words, they will do the work for you. They will create an impossible story because that's what they're trying to convey. And that's what was happening with the ghost work in the 70s. Somebody went to the Docklands, which is an area in London, created this idea, sort of spread the word, as it were, about a ghost there. And then the witnesses did the work for them. They started to tell other people about the ghost. The legend grew. Other people claimed to have seen the ghost, experienced it, and so on. So it speaks to this idea about how unreliable testimony is, which magicians kind of know. My favorite thing about that is when, you know, you do a trick for somebody and there's this very strange social phenomena that they then say, "Oh, come and show my friends."
Yeah.
It's a very strange thing that they want to say, "Show my friends." And the worst one is they go, you know, "Oh, just show," you know, in front of their friends, they'll say, "Oh, do that one where the card ends up in the wallet." So even if you achieve it, there's no surprise. And now it's harder to achieve because they know what the end point is. So that's very annoying. But it is phenomenal that people do our work for us in terms of magic.
Well, that's true. And then most times you cannot recreate what they said. He did this and that, and it ended up over here, and it was an impossible situation. Yeah. More than it's like, yeah, that's right, but I do something different now.
That's right. That's right. Hold on to this one sponge ball and let's see how we go. Yes, that's right.
Exactly.
The vanishing elephant.
The reason I wanted to bring that up is because that some years ago, a business partner of mine, Jamie Salinas, and I used to do seances on a regular basis. And there was, should I make the story short? But basically, there was someone who was wanting us to do a seance in their store. So we created a story. We went on to the store's Facebook page, and we were talking about this, I'd forgotten what we could, the Weeping Willow Widow is what we called her. Okay. We said that to understand in this area where this store was, basically, back a long time ago, there was a lady who had a fiance, and she stood him up, and she ended up hanging herself on this willow tree and died. And that was basically the story. And has anyone heard this story before? And we put it out on Facebook. And before long, someone said, "Yeah, you know, I think I heard of such and such." And then before long, there was a thread of people making up the story for us, which we then used in the seance, which was completely fabricated.
It's amazing. And part of that is, of course, the lure of the seance. You know, this idea of being in darkness with luminous tabs on objects. I started out, as you said in the intro there, with Andy Nyman many, many years ago doing those sorts of seances, the Eugene Berger seance. And it was so much fun and so unlike a magic show. In a magic show, you want to do as much as possible, where in a seance, you really want to tread that line of uncertainty. And if you produce something incredible, people go, "Oh, this is a magic show." And now they're in a different frame of mind. They need to be in this frame of mind of, "I don't know quite what I'm looking at here. Maybe it is genuine, or maybe it's trickery, or maybe it's an optical illusion." And that sense of uncertainty around the seance context, I think, makes it really, really interesting. So yeah, big, big fan of seances. And then, as you said, and the problem with them is that you're always performing to 15, 20 people maximum. Mm-hmm. So at Magic Live, we made it into a huge Powers of Darkness routine where we took 10 people, put them into a dark room, and the other 500 saw an infrared feed. So they could see the trickery, as it were, that was going on in the darkness. So yeah, it was a lot of fun and quite an ambitious thing to do, actually. It's the first time we'd done it at Magic Live, so it was terrifying.
I like the setup on that, because the people that you were sitting in the room saying, "Well, we're going to rotate people," as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, so this way the people felt like, well, nobody's going to be watching us. I mean, you didn't say, "We're going to put you in here and you're going to be on TV. We're going to, I think, put you in here and then we'll have another group then later," or whatever. And then after they went and sit down, what they don't know is that we're going to be watching them, right?
There was a lot of that. And also, when they came back out, they could give us the firsthand testimony of what happened in the darkness, and we'd seen the reality of it. And we had lots of earpieces, so the medium was not on an earpiece, so I could find out information about people in the group from the big audience and feed it to the medium and so on. It was a lot of fun to do. And I told Stan I'd done it before, just so that he'd definitely book it and go ahead with it.
But in reality?
And of course I hadn't. Of course I hadn't. I think he may have known, actually. It was like all good projects, you know, terrifying. You got to take risks. And we took a big one there, and it kind of paid off.
It did. But did you learn from that and then do it again, or was that a one and done?
No, we then did it at Blackpool. So we did it there, but it's a big old thing to do, and you can only really do it for magicians because of the exposure involved with the methods. So yeah, we did it there, and again went down very well. So it was lots of fun, and it was built on probably, I don't know, 120 seances that I've done for smaller kind of groups. So it was it was great to then take it to magicians and make it this big. It's what Magic Live's great, you know, taking an event and just suddenly giving it a twist and making it this really large event or really special in a particular way.
Well, you had obviously planned that quite thoroughly, but there was the other thing that I referred to in which, as I recall, didn't we have laser pointers or something we were using?
Yes, that was experimental. So yeah, because I'm based in Edinburgh, I do a lot of work at the Edinburgh Fringe. In fact, I've got a show coming up in August.
I want to talk about that shortly too. Yeah,
thank you. What I always do with any sort of creativity project is go, what is everyone else doing? Can I do the opposite? Mm-hmm. So that's always my mantra for you know, sort of doing kind of creativity stuff. And so when I looked at the Edinburgh Fringe, I thought every show has a presenter. It has a comedian or a magician or actors. Can we do a show without anyone on stage? And that's a really weird and exciting idea. Mm-hmm. And so we had this idea of about 100 people coming in. They would sit down. They'd have an envelope, which would have some materials inside. And they would just read slides and watch video. And they would be taken through a show. Mm-hmm. So there was psychology stuff in there, optical illusions, and magic. We had one of the early Woody Aragon tear it up, count it, in there. And so we did that. And it worked. And again, that was a huge risk. I really remember the very first performance when people came in and there's 100 of them. And it's one thing to create this stuff in your living room and in your head. It's another when you see the people sitting there and thinking, I hope this is going to work because I've never done this before. And so we start the show. Music was essential because otherwise the room felt dead. So there was a big music track behind it. And it worked. People had fun for 40 minutes. And part of that, I did come out at the very beginning and I said to people, this is your show. And if you want to make it a silly show or to kill the show or to ruin it, you can do that. And they took responsibility and actually did everything they could to make the show work. Mm-hmm. And the very opening of it, which I think we then used at Magic Live when we did a shortened version of it, was one of my favorite moments, which is we had two buttons on stage, big buttons that you could press, like a yellow one and a blue one. And it just came up on the screen. One of these buttons starts the show. One of them ends the show. Somebody press a button. And the audience would sit there and look at each other and nudge each other. And eventually someone would come up onto the stage and get a cheer. They'd hit a button. And whichever button they'd hit, the whole show would just end. It would just go, ooh. And it would just sit there until somebody shouted out, press the other button. And I hit the other button, and then suddenly we go into the show with all the music and so on. But I love that as beginning, because it had that kind of sense of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And then we took a shortened version of that over to Magic Live, and Stan sorted out all the logistics. It was, lots of fun to do. I think we did it 8 times at Magic Live.
It's kind of a woman or tiger door thing, right?
What's that?
I said it's kind of the woman or the tiger that... The story, you know, which door that you're going to open, and it's either a woman or it's a tiger behind the door.
Okay.
It's an old story, an O. Henry story, I think. Anyhow, that was really great. And so you say you're going to be taking that to the Fringe Festival.
No, the new show is called The Invention of Magic, and this is about the magic of Paul Curry. And the reason for this was I went around all these Fringe shows with a friend last year. Fringe magic shows. It's about 60 of them. And my friend said to me, hold on a minute, we're seeing the same tricks. And I went, yeah. And they went, so these magicians, they're not creating these tricks, are they? And I said, no, you buy them or read about them.
Right.
And she went, well, comedians, you'd never get away with that with comedy. No. They don't stand up and do somebody else's material.
Right.
And I suddenly realized that audiences knew nothing about the invention of magic. So this is saying to an audience, magic is invented normally by a different group of people to the performers, and we're going to investigate that through Paul Curry, and we look at how magic evolves and changes, and so I perform a 1936 card trick, and then say how Paul Curry looked at that and improved it in 1937 and do an improved version of it. And it's about trying to stop them thinking, how's that done, and replacing it with, oh, that's really interesting. And getting into the culture of magic, stuff that we love, but audiences just don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And I performed it in December at the Magic Festival here, and it went down pretty well. People liked it. So I'm going to be back in the final week of the festival towards the end of August doing it.
And I take it that you have been to the festival and performed there before?
Many.
On several occasions, yeah.
I was on the board of it. Helped to run it.
Oh, were you? Okay.
Yes.
Because I understand that's quite a daunting thing because there are so many different venues. I've heard even in the car, people will do a play in their front seat of the car or something. I mean, they're looking for any and every place, regardless of how large or small it is.
Yeah, it's very, very hard to get your head around the size of it. It's the largest arts festival in the world. I think any one day will have about 3,000 performances.
3,000 performances? Yes. Oh, my gosh, in a day.
Yes. It's so every space in the city becomes a performance space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredible. So I'd always urge people to come. I think there's about 60 magic shows this year. And so you have to be able to stand out from the crowd one way or another. But the Invention of Magic is a small show. It's a quiet show. And I'm just sort of, I'd like, also it doesn't feel like an egotistical thing because you're talking about another person's genius mm-hmm. and about this thing you love. Which again makes it very, very different to a kind of look at me show, which right. is how most magicians do their shows. The other curious thing, I was looking at the blurb. You have to write a couple of lines about the show for the program, which is sitting next to me. I'd written mine in the first person. I'd said, this is about my love of magic. And most of the blurbs, in fact, all of the others, are written in third person. It's come along and see John Smith do an incredible show.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the kind of personal aspect of a first person, non-egotistical, quiet thing, which is just saying to people, the culture of magic is fascinating. I'm going to tell you a bit more about it. And it's not a challenge scenario. So when I did it in December at the Magic Fest, I was doing Paul Curry's Hats and Magicians trick. It's a great, great trick, but it does involve counting. And I miscounted. So I looked down and I said to the audience, I'm sorry, this occasionally happens. I have messed this up genuinely. And someone in the audience said, oh, don't worry, just reset it and show us it again. And mm-hmm. that was because there was no challenge in the room. You know, I wasn't saying, look at me doing all my clever stuff. It was
interesting.
Talking about this other person's genius.
Right.
I'm just showing you some interest. And so it feels different. I'm very interested in different frames, different ways of presenting magic.
Hmm. Wow. I like that. That's interesting about how that, different ways of framing it. What reminds me that Paul Daniels did one on Max Malini some years ago.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Great show. Yeah, really good. And did some great Malini material. So I think those sorts of shows, which are just, you know, magic is fascinating. You know, we write everything down. We've got a literature that goes back, you know, 200 years, you can ask Alexander with whatever it is, 3 million pages of information on it. And audiences don't know any of this stuff. And I think to give them a little peek behind the curtain is good for magic. And it gets over this idea, you know, my friend's comment of, hold on a minute, you guys didn't invent this stuff. You're all doing the same material.
Right.
And just being honest about that, I think is an interesting thing to do.
In Branson, Missouri, there are several magicians who work, and I say several, maybe about 7 or 8 different magicians. And if you go to each show, you're going to see at least one thing or two, like linking rings, for an example, or a cube zag or whatever it is. It's like, if you are an audience member, a general public who is a non-magician, you're going to say, wait a minute, I think I saw that at this other show. There is a lot of commonality among magicians, although the presentations obviously are completely different. One person could do a comedy linking rings and someone do something serious or different classical music or whatever it is, but it's still basically effect to the audience is the same.
Yeah. And also taking credit for that as if they invented the linking rings.
Mm.
And you think, no, you didn't. Somebody else did that. You might have a little twist on it or whatever, but it isn't yours. And just being honest about that, it's a difficult thing for magicians to do. But comedians wouldn't do it. You'd never go out and all tell the same funny story. And if it's a play, well, that is happening, you know it wasn't written by the people on stage. You know it's a play and you can buy that play and so on. So it's just being a little bit more honest and trying to take the puzzle element. You know, I always say the worst magic shows are 45 minutes of puzzles you can't solve, a 20-minute break, and another 45 minutes of puzzles you can't solve. That's a bad show.
No, and
no wonder people end up not liking magicians. So it's trying to take the element out and going, you know, I'm showing you this stuff, but for another reason. It's because I'm telling you about the history of magic or how magic evolves or whatever. And playing with those frames, I think, is essential for the future of magic. We have to get away from this kind of challenge aspect, puzzly aspect, in my opinion.
Well, there again, you touched on something which would be like a magician in trouble syndrome that most magicians, including myself, will say, oh, it's a great trick. And we all have those kinds of things in there in which the audience might be in on it, or you're fooling someone, or else you bring them along and then you say, fooled you, you know, at the end. So it makes them kind of look a little bit foolish for not understanding the puzzle. What are your thoughts on those kinds of magician in trouble tricks?
Stop doing it. Stop doing it. Nobody likes it. Nobody likes to be fooled. I think you have to be authentic and honest. And all of those sucker type tricks aren't honest. They just look at me, you know, oh, look, you know, you thought I'd messed up. I haven't. And you think, well, great, but how's that about an audience member? It should be all about them and the experience they're having. It shouldn't be about you. You know, the method is just a way of producing that experience. You know, we don't put on a VR headset and go, my goodness, one amazing bit of code. We talk about the experience. I'm sure some people do. I'm sure if you're a coder, you do. But the point is that it's a magical experience for the person, and that's what it should be for the audience, not kind of, oh, well done, you managed to fool me, you managed to trick me. And I think that small shift of just thinking about effects and the impact on the audience will get you a very, very long way.
In other words, treat your audience as if they are sentient beings and intelligent.
Treat your audience as if they're the only thing that matters. And it's your job to give them a good time or an interesting time or a time they'll talk about with their friends. It isn't about you. That would be my number one mantra, because that's what we should be doing as performers. You know, David Berglass, passed on a few years ago, but I spent many a happy evening with David. And at one point, we're going through his scrapbooks, and there was a picture of him, I think as a 7 or 8 year old, doing a play or something on stage. And I said, is this your first performance? And he said, oh, no, I wasn't performing. I was showing off. I said, what's the difference? He said, showing off is all about yourself. Performing is all about the audience. And it's absolutely key, I think.
Love it.
That we shouldn't be showing off. We should be thinking, how do we give these people a wonderful time? That's what they're paying for. That's what they want. A magical experience. What does that even mean? It's going to be about them, making them feel good, feel special, feel interested, whatever it is, whatever the emotion is. Start with that. Not start with, wouldn't it be great if they just, you know, I managed to fool them and show that I'm smarter than them, using somebody else's tricks I didn't invent.
Or you just want to show them this box that makes something disappear. Isn't this cool? Well,
that's right.
Focuses on the effect and not on the audience.
But who, you know, who cares? Who cares that you can do that? Nobody, I suspect. When I did do close-up magic, which is many years ago, is table hopping, I was very interested in effects that could happen in my absence. Mm. So I actually used to finish with showing people like a two of spades, and I used to do this particularly with kids, and so I like this card because there's lots of blank space, and I put it face down on the table. Then I get the kid to pretend to pick up a red crayon and draw a circle, another color crayon, and dots, another color crayon, and do a half circle. And I go, oh, you did that really well. It's fantastic. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed yourself at the restaurant, and I'll see you later. Walk away.
Wow. Okay.
When they turned over the card, in crayon was a smiley face on the card. But they found that in my absence. And the reaction was so much stronger because I could hear it. It was their private moment that they go, oh my goodness, look here. And I wasn't there at that point. It wasn't about me. And it was so much stronger for it. And I'm just interested in exploring these different ways of doing the thing I love, which is magic. But it has to change and evolve, I think.
In the original lecture notes of Prethos by Banachek, when we'd put this out, and I say the first one, it had his whole act, start to finish. And at the ending of it, it was explaining what he would finish this last trick, and an audience member was on stage holding a piece of paper towards themselves or whatever. And he would say, okay, I've done this, this, and this, kind of reminding everybody what they did. And then I finished with this drawing duplication or whatever it is. And so this person is holding them right now. Thank you very much and good night. And he walks off and this person is still standing there, like looking around. It's like, and then everybody says, what is it? And they finally turn around, you know, and they get applause. Right. And he'd been doing that for a long number of years. And apparently Max Maven had that in his routine too, because Max contacted us and he said, that's actually my routine and you shouldn't be publishing that. And so we took it out. And so it never appeared again, you know, even though that it was independently thought of, but it was just a great routine though.
It's the same thought, you know, it's an unusual piece of theater. I can see that coming from Max as well, actually. Mm-hmm. It's an unusual thing to do, but it takes... Yeah, I think it's a Tommy Wonder idea, isn't it? That when the effect happens, you shouldn't look at people. You should look away from them because mm-hmm. it amplifies their reaction. It's a private moment. You wouldn't stare at somebody when you want them to respond in a certain
good
way.
Point.
It's, mm-hmm. it's just an amplification of that, of not being present, because it shouldn't be about you. It's about giving that audience, in my example, it was about just giving that kid a moment of turning the card over. And it's their experience, and that's my job, is to give them an interesting experience, not for them to think, oh, isn't Wiseman amazing? And and once you think about things like that, that's what sits behind the seance stuff as well. It's just interesting and experimental where there's no performer, and the Paul Curry show that we're going to be doing. So, yeah, I think that's the little theme there.
Well, kind of circling back to a few other things that we've kind of touched on, that is Andy Nyman and seances and thin theater. Have you been consulting and worked with Andy? I know that Andy's done several things then with Darren Brown. And have you done some things with Darren as well for his show? And
yeah, not so much the live stuff, but two of the TV shows. The very first special I was on, Darren's very first special, he came to the university to film it. And we bonded very, very quickly, because we both had a very similar sense of humor. And we were supposed to do this interview about twins mm-hmm. and could not get through it because we kept giggling like schoolboys. Uh-huh. And in the end, I think Andrew Connor got maybe slightly annoyed with us and told us to get on with it. And we did. And then, yeah, he's become a very good friend since then. I've appeared in some of the other TV stuff. And he did a TV show about luck, which is based on my Luck Factor book. And then Andy, I was at a close-up convention, Mark Leverage close-up convention a million years ago. And boy, I was doing my close-up act. It was awful. It was bad. It was almost as bad as my street work. And I was doing toppet work, and Michael Lamar was there. And I was missing the toppet. Things were coming out the toppet that I hadn't put in the toppet. It was awful. And again, I found it very funny. I looked up and there was Andy killing himself laughing. I didn't know him at that point. Uh-huh. And so afterwards he came over and said, oh, I really enjoyed that. And he gave me a lift back to London. We chatted. And that's where we found out we got this love of seances. I'd seen Eugene Berger come over to give a close-up lecture. At the end of that lecture, he said, I've got one copy of Spirit Theater. And I went and bought it. Changed my life. I read that book. Love it so much. And Andy had read it as well. And we got together and did that. So some of Andy's ghost stories play is based around my stuff. So that play, if you haven't seen it, as the sort of main character is Professor Goodman, which is a play on Wiseman. And some of the ghost stuff in there is based on my ghost stuff. So yeah, we've all been swimming in the same pond.
As I was going to ask you about ghost stories, because I understand that was that written then by Andy and you had consulted, because he did that, turned into a movie then as well.
That's correct. So it's written by... Andy and Jeremy Dyson, as a very famous writer over here, they put together, and it uses some of my material from the ghost work that I've done and a story that actually happened to me, which I won't spoil for people, when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and it's about a ghost lecture and so on. So, yeah, a little bit of consulting for both that and the film.
And talking about seances as well, that one of the things I was thinking about, and I wanted to circle back then too, is when people come to seances, they come with preconceived notions. Either they believe in it or they don't, and they're not going to change their mind. They either come as a skeptic or they come as a believer and they want to ask you questions afterwards. Do you try to convince people, or you just present it the way you normally do and try to make it entertaining, or do you try to make it more believable, to make people question?
Yeah, well, I thought long and hard about that framing, and it comes back to honesty. So we frame it as a theatrical reconstruction of a Victorian seance. We're trying to give you the experience of what it would have been like 100 and something years ago to go to a darkroom seance. Mm-hmm. And I say to the group, I will play the role of the medium. You will play the role as the sitters. If you want to be skeptical, be skeptical. If you want to believe, believe. But I will promise you just one thing, which is an interesting evening. And that's my only promise. Hmm. And then we do the show, blah, blah, blah. Things happen. And at the end of it, I say I made a promise, which was to give you an interesting evening. And I hope I've kept my promise. And that's that. So you don't want to start off by saying what you're about to see is a magic show. And for me, you definitely don't want to say you're going to see something genuine. So we always frame it as a reconstruction to give you the experience of what it'd been like to take part in one of these wonderful events over 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then it's quite carefully discussed at the end. So in fact, I probably did it on Magic Live as well. I will say things like, you know, I don't know what you thought of that, but imagine 100 and something years ago, what it'd been like to have seen that before telephones, before technology and so on. Get yourself into that mindset. And we're just completely sidestepping the, is it genuine or not? Because to me, that's the least interesting question, given what we're doing.
So that helps avoid people coming to you afterwards and queuing up to say, am I going to win the lottery, or will I get this job, or when am I getting married, or kind of a thing, right?
Absolutely. And I've never had anything like that. People just come and have an enjoyable time. And again, it just feels like we're giving them something. We're giving them an interesting experience they can tell their friends about. And the group will talk about methods. You know, often, so the way our seance is configured, there's nothing to find afterwards. There's no threads, there's no magnets, there's the objects, which is a ball and a slate and so on. They're all ungimmicked. So I walk out of the room. You know, I say, thanks, blah, 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 walk out. The audience can look under the table. They can do whatever they want. There's nothing to find. And interesting conversations will flow from that. But that's their conversation. It's not what I'm involved in. Otherwise, I'm going to have to be honest and tell them exactly what's going on.
You don't want to do that.
No.
As busy as you are with so many other different projects, how often do you do seances? Or is it a certain time of the year? Do you believe that people are more susceptible or looking for seances in October around Halloween or throughout the rest of the year? Or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done them for a while. So we did loads of them, different science festivals and different arts festivals. And for experiments, I published papers on them, did them at Magic Live. But it's something that sits in the cupboard. That we'll get and do again. But at the minute, I'm so busy. I have a new kind of book out on kids' magic and so on. So sort of rushing around doing stuff. So, but the seance, it always holds a special part in my heart because it's such fun. And those methods that the Victorian fake spiritualists pioneered, they work. They work today. And when you think of the technological advances, you know, that we carry around smartphones that can do things that just would seem impossible to Victorians. Still, you know, the methods of the seances from all those years ago frighten and fool people nowadays, which is a phenomenal thought.
Yeah, whether you're using threads or whatever else. I mean, there are all kinds of electronic methods, of course, that are available and for sale to the bizarre community, if you will. When we've done seances, I often find that just an old-fashioned string and a pulley. It's just
simple stuff that works. Electronics scare me. I'm just so scared of the batteries going or whatever it is. So no, we use simple things that are written up in books, you know, from 1890, something like that. It's always the simple stuff. It's what Eugene preaches in that, the Spirit of Ghetto book.
Have you ever been involved with a Houdini seance?
No, I've been involved in lots of, quote, genuine seances with genuine mediums. I mean, I sat in a lot of those, and they're dreadful. They're really bad because they're not dealing with people who are looking at the frame of this as being a trick. They're dealing with believers, so you don't need to do anything that's very impressive. But I've sat in a lot of those, never been convinced by any of it. I've gone to many haunted houses and never seen a ghost and so on. So I'm pretty skeptical about the paranormally stuff, but still find it fascinating.
Yeah, it is so much fun. I have been doing them for a long time then as well. But as far as the Houdini seance, once they had the official seance that was on Halloween in Fort Worth, Texas, many years ago, and I was tapped to be the medium. So I came out on stage and talked a little bit about Houdini. We had John Cox, who had shown some things, and we had somebody who did a straitjacket and did different kinds of things for this group. And then because the public had been invited then as well for this particular seance, and then we went down to a table where there were just the 13 of us that were around, Sid Radner's descendant, I've forgotten, his grandson or somebody, and other people who would kind of tie back to Houdini. We had different artifacts on the table, and I was doing all the talking and trying to get Houdini to come back. But it was a fun evening, official kind of a thing.
Did he turn up?
Well, it was a weird thing that kind of happened. It's just one of those things, coincidences happen, in which that, you know, you say things and then you stop. And there was a program of the evening's activities that everyone had, and that was sitting on the table. And at some point, whenever I had asked for some manifestation of some sort to happen, the program opened up. It popped open. I mean, that didn't open to a page. It just kind of, it had been sitting there for clearly 15 minutes or so. And then it just kind of, like, it sprung open a little bit, kind of is the best way of saying it. It was just kind of interesting and coincidental during the time that we were talking that something, it could have been the humidity in the room that finally had hit it. I mean, there are all kinds of scientific ways of trying to go back and explain it, but yeah, it was a coincidence.
But it's an uncanny, creepy one. I mean, yes. Had that just completely folded over, you'd have gone, oh, someone's setting me up. This is a thread or whatever. It's right. The small things. It's the small things that make you go, ooh. I remember we did a seance actually here in Edinburgh probably about 10 years ago. And I'm doing the initial kind of blur thing on it. It's quiet in the room. It's only about 10 people. I'm just talking to them in total darkness. And I'm hearing a scratching sound off to the side. It's a definite scratching sound. And my fear was that someone had broken away from the circle and was messing around. Uh-huh. So I asked everyone to hold hands. Then we go around the group. We say our names into the darkness. And I'm counting around. So I know everyone's around that circle. I'm definitely hearing it. And then I realize it's a rat.
Oh, my.
So we're in this kind of underground cavern-y bit. And I've never been so scared in my life because I'm sort of... I'm thinking, this audience are thinking, maybe we're doing that. I know what it actually is. And now I am afraid.
Now you're really scared.
Yeah. But it's a small thing, tiny thing again, that's just, mm-hmm. that just kind of, oh, that's a bit creepy. So yes, it's the small stuff,
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point that sometimes I think magicians want to overplay their hand and think, well, something needs to fall over, you know, or that wooden stick or something, you know, that whatever. But yeah, I think it's the small things that people will say, did you hear that? Or did you see that? Because not everybody may experience the same thing. Which is why at the beginning of our seance, we may say there will be certain things that some people hear, but others don't, or some things that some people will see out of the corner of your eyes and the other people won't. But I want you to be completely aware of all your senses, all five of your senses, using them to make a sixth sense. So that's a way that you can almost feel something that's going to be happening, basically, because each of you will experience this in a different way. And I'm saying that because I know that some people believe and some people don't, but it's trying to make everybody to have their senses heightened. And once that they do, then they're going to be more open whenever they do hear something, or like, let's say we're doing PsychoConnect touches and you tap somebody, they're sensitive to the fact that, yes, he touched me three times on my shoulder or something. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And too much, and it becomes a trick, and they're into trick solving.
Exactly.
But less than that, and it becomes much more fun for them to discuss. So yeah, interesting.
So that's something right now that you just kind of put on the shelf for a while, and you're going to come back to it a later time. But
yeah, I'm sure it will come back to haunt us, as it were. So right now I'm concentrating on the Paul Curry thing, and I've got this new kids book out, which is Magic Your Mind Happy, which is kind of teaching kids magic, but actually really teaching essential life skills. So I looked at tricks that would teach confidence or creativity or curiosity. So it's a kind of fun way of doing a new kids book.
I want to talk about that here. So tell me some more about the book. What's the title of the book again?
It's Magic Your Mind Happy.
Yep.
And I went in to pitch to the kids publisher, Hachette, in this country, very big kids publisher. And I said, look, you know, let's do a magic book, and let's do one that's never been done before, which is that we can use magic as a vehicle to teach all the amazing skills that we know magic gives you, that we take for granted.
Right.
You know, a part of it is the community. You know, isn't it amazing that you can go anywhere in the world pretty much and instantly meet up with a group of people? And
like-minded people.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we take that for granted. Mm. And it's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, all of my friends I've known since I was probably 19, 20 years old. And they're all met through magic. we take it for granted about having a little bit of confidence because we know we can break the ice at a party or something with a little trick or pick something up. So the social skills, the confidence, the curiosity that magicians have, the fact we know a bit of chemistry, a bit of physics, a bit of maths when we do the magic square, we take it for granted. And all these things, I thought magic is a wonderful vehicle, so that the book is written to teach kids those life skills, which I think are very important skills, through the medium of magic. So they learn tricks. And then I say, try variations on this. This is what somebody came. I teach the jumping elastic band, two fingers, the
right,
other two
right.
fingers. And say that was invented in 1911. 40 years later, somebody has the idea of putting a twisted band across the tops of the fingers. What can you do with it? We're not finished with this yet. There's something still to be developed. So it's about growth and development and about resilience. I mean, my goodness, magicians are ready for failure. They know what to do when things go wrong. They've got outs. Precautions.
Right.
And that's a good lesson in life. And so it's about all those things. It's about using magic as this kind of springboard for life skills. And I've been going around book festivals talking about it. And it's been lots of fun, actually.
And it's for what age group?
About 9 to adult, it turns out. So it's illustrated, and it was fun to put together. I should say David Britland was a consultant on it. Will Houston was a consultant. So sort of really lovely to work with very knowledgeable people. Nine upwards. And when I've been doing these book festivals, it's just been a joy, because instead of just saying, oh, magic's about method, you know, you can get to talk about the complexity of magic and what would have happened if you'd chosen this other card. And actually, I've got an out here that you never saw, or, you know, how, you know, even just getting someone to take a card, we forget how much we've learned in how to do that. You know, hold on to one of these, not take a card, because take a card, now they're going to get a bit suspicious. But you hold on to one of these, you turn the head away slightly as you spread the cards, now it looks like you couldn't possibly be doing a classic force. Right. All those little bits. So yeah, I've been going around talking about that stuff, and hopefully getting people, you know, into magic at a young age in the right direction.
And again, the title is Magic the Mind.
Magic Your Mind Happy.
Magic Your Mind. So you're using magic as a verb, basically. Magic Your Mind
Correct.
Happy. Yeah,
okay. Correct. That's right. Yes, yes, indeed. Yeah.
That's why it's hard to remember. Magic Your Mind Happy.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's not an easy one, but so it's been fun. It's been fun.
And so is this available internationally? I assume on Amazon
I think so. And it came out of all the work that I was doing, looking at magic being used outside of the entertainment context. So I'd worked with College of Magic in South Africa, who are using it with marginalized communities to build confidence. Magic Care in the Netherlands, who are doing magic in hospitals. And a lot of that happens in the States as well. Breathe in this country, in the UK, who we've got kids with movement difficulties, and then teaching them tricks, getting them to repeat movements, but in a meaningful kind of way. Rich McDougall, very good friend of mine, involved in all of that. I was doing this work, and I put together an academic book about all of that work, all the scientific research that's showing that it's extremely effective, so that practitioners would have a single book they could go to. So that's a kind of semi-academic book. And then out of that came the Magic Your Mind Happy, which was a fun book for kids, basically, with the same lessons in. So it's been a couple of years in the making.
And your first children's book.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think my 12th book. 12th commercial book, but first children's book.
Right. Well, as we start to wrap up, why would be remiss if I don't talk about Quirkology and a little bit about some of the videos. How many videos actually have you put out there?
There's not, well, for Quirkology, not that many. I think there's like maybe 25, something like
okay.
that. It's it's not a huge number.
And but it's a huge number of views. Oh my goodness, 800 million?
It's astonishing. And it happened from day one. We did color changing card trick on day one, and YouTube hadn't been around. It had been around about a year and a bit. We had a downtime with the group. We filmed color changing card trick. We uploaded it. And I won't say what that video is about, because it'll spoil it for people, but if they want to go watch it, it's out there. Woke up in the morning, and it was 250,000 views.
Oh, my.
And I thought, my goodness, it's incredible. And at that point, I was used to magic being on television, which meant you made a pitch to a commissioning editor, and maybe you'd get a show or something. But this meant I could do just 5 minutes, and it was my own thing. I was in charge of it. So we started producing these illusions where you see something incredible, then you realize the ridiculous method that we're using. Mm-hmm. And people kind of loved it, and it's still being used today. You know, teachers use them a lot in classroom for creativity, showing the first part and people are trying to guess how it's done and so on.
Or counting the number of times they catch the basketball or whatever.
And all that stuff. Yeah, the basketball video, it was actually Dan Simon's, a friend of mine. But that same kind of area. And then I think we put out one video, which was bets you'd always win. 10 bets you would always win, which again is the stuff we learned when we're like 7 or 8 years old, you know, all that, those old books.
Yeah.
It's so old, it's new. You know, that whole thing of, I don't know, whatever it is, you put the banknote under the bottle. Can you take away the banknote without removing the bottle? All those things that we all learned. But you forget, again, most people don't know that stuff. And so he's putting those out and they just racked up, you know, 40 million views one of those videos have got.
Wow.
And they're all just filmed in my lounge. We never spent more than $30 on any video at all. They're all low tech. And they all speak to the power of magic, I think, that people just love what we do.
Well, we do. I certainly do. I like watching them and watching them over and over again. It's like, how did that get me? Just a minute, even with an explanation, I still like to see, okay, well, oh, now I see that. So It makes such great sense. Are you still coming out with some of those things and got some ideas? Or
yeah, if I get an idea, and I'll do it. The last one was was actually during the pandemic, which was a little box where we produced two ping pong balls from. And I love the method. We were going to expose the method. It's a little brown box. You open it up and it's empty. Then you produce a table tennis ball, shut it, and again, another table tennis ball. It looks impossible. And I watched the video and I thought, I cannot bring myself to expose that. I love it. I love it so much. So we just put out the effect on that one. And of course, you know, in all those years we've been doing it, I don't know what it's been now, 15 years, we've never had a single complaint from a magician because the methods are all so ridiculous. You couldn't possibly use them live on stage and so on. But what they do is celebrate the genius of magic. It's magic thinking, but in a completely different way. And as you say, once you realize what the method is, you go back and think, oh, that's why they did it in exactly that way, and so on.
Right.
And most of them took 2-3 days to film, even though maybe you end up with maybe 60 seconds of footage, because mm-hmm. we just do it again and again. A lot of them are probabilistic, that a ball has to land in exactly the right moment, exactly the right time. So I'm surrounded by endless outtakes of us getting it wrong, basically. But no, it was a joy and lovely that people still enjoy them.
Do people send you ideas also saying, hey, here's, or maybe some of their own videos? Has this spawned a generation of others doing the similar thing? Or?
No, it hasn't. What it has spawned is a generation of people that grew up on them. So sometimes sure. when I go to a student group, those people will be in their early 20s and they go, oh my goodness, it's the Quirkology man. I used to watch you when I was 8 years old. You're sure. the reason I got into psychology, and which is both delightful and horrific at the same time.
Making you feel old.
Yes, absolutely. In my head, I'm still 25.
Exactly. Well, that is, again, a wonderful series. And the reason you call it Quirkology, because it was kind of quirky in psychology. It was kind of the fusion. Yeah.
All these things are chance. Freakonomics, which was a huge book, came out.
Love their podcast. Yeah.
It's great. It's great. And I gave a talk somewhere. Somebody asked about Freakonomics. And I said, well, I'm not an economist. I'm a psychologist, but I do quirky psychology. So if I was going to do it, it would be called quirky psychology. And no, actually, it'd be called Quirkology. And then I left that talk. It was a talk in America, actually. I went to the airport. I opened a paperback novel I got because there was a blank bit of paper at the back, and I wrote down the contents of a Quirkology book, a book on quirky psychology, mm-hmm. and word for word, that became the contents of the actual Quirkology book that came out, and then the YouTube channel was off the back of that. So we love to think that our lives are governed by our big thoughts and our big decisions, it's rubbish. It's chance. It's luck. And most of the things I've done, you know, it's just because I've been lucky and fortunate and thought, oh, hold on a second. There's another way of doing this. Let's all have some fun.
And that was one of the title of your early book. What was that, the Luck Factor?
Luck Factor was the first one, and Quirkology was the second book.
So Quirkology was on the back of the Luck Factor, basically.
Yeah, that's right. And then I had this idea. I went out for coffee with a friend of mine, CEO, and she said, you understand about happiness. Can you explain how to be happy? So I started to explain about the psychology of happiness. She looked at her watch, and she said, can you get on with it? And I said, how long have you got? She said, I'm busy, about a minute. So I tried to explain what she could do to be happier in a minute and could do something. And then I went away again. And I thought, there's quite a lot of psychology you could deliver in a minute. And that became the basis. That thought, that coffee became the basis for 59 Seconds, which became the biggest book for me, which are things you can learn in less than a minute. So again, you know, we love to think, oh, yeah, you know, you have these big brainstorming ideas, mm-hmm. you have these genius thoughts. It's rubbish. I went out for coffee by chance. This thing happened.
Fate or whatever you want to call it.
Whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Just the right place, the right time.
Yeah. And recognizing an opportunity and doing what magicians do best, which is being agile enough to change and to follow that opportunity. We do it when we put an act together, you know, where people just change around instantly and change the order of things. We do it in performances where we see an opportunity and we go for it. It's a very flexible way of looking at the world.
When you're looking at your audience and you're going with what they enjoy, not necessarily what's on your cue sheet.
Yeah. But we all know the best lines come to you at that moment when you're staring at people and you've got to come up with something funny. And for whatever reason, the gods smile on you and you do. And that's the line that stays in for the next decade.
That's true.
And again, you know, that flexibility we take for granted, but it's not built into many, many activities. So again, it's another, you know, we give to magic, but my goodness, do we get a lot from the culture and community of magic.
Wow. Well, this has been, I can't believe how quickly this has flown by, and we can talk for a lot longer then as well. But I want to end with, as I always do, by asking what it is that's your magic word, what's your phrase, or what's your philosophy of life? There were so many different things that you had mentioned through there, but what's important that keeps you going every day?
Probably what I find amazing about the world, and particularly about magic, is that you take the cups and balls, ambitious cards, tricks that have been around for a very long time, that many, many people have looked at, and still there's stuff to be discovered. Still, I go to a convention and there'll be a person doing it in a new way with a new move, a new presentation. And it's so easy to think, oh my goodness, there's nothing new to be discovered. And absolutely, there's new stuff out there. There's innovative ways of doing things that haven't been discovered yet. And it's that future hasn't happened. It's up to us to create it. And we're just the custodians of magic. You know, the previous generation passed it on to us. And it's our job to make it as good as possible for the next generation. And if we do that, we'll have done something worthwhile. So I think that's my philosophy.
It's kind of like Vernon says, don't stop thinking.
Yeah, don't stop trying to improve magic, because we've got a job to do, which is to pass it on to the next generation.
That's true. Very true. Well, for people who are interested in buying your book, we talked about Amazon.com. Is there a website people can go to, or someplace you would recommend people?
There is. I've got a website, richardweisman.com is out there, and I'm on Twitter as @RichardWiseman. I'm very, very pro-live stuff, so I try and do as much of it as possible. If I'm giving a talk or a convention or something, please come along and say hello. It's always a delight. And thank you for inviting me on your wonderful podcast. Congratulations on the fantastic work you do.
Thank you very much. I enjoy doing it because of you, people like you that help make my day and just make this a delight to share time together. So I've really enjoyed it then as well. So I appreciate it. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Richard, Dr. Professor. So how do you go by? Do you go by Professor or do you go by Doctor?
Cool, Richard. Just call me Richard.
There he was. That was Richard Weisman. Scotty out.
Thank you very much, Richard, for being my guest this week. I certainly enjoyed our conversation, and I enjoyed actually making a new friend. This was so much fun, and for you listeners, I wish you could have heard the rest of what we were talking about for another hour afterwards. Anyhow, we just got to know each other, and I'm so looking forward to actually sitting down and having a proper cup of tea with Professor Wiseman in the future, whenever we get together at Blackpool or wherever it might be. I'm sure that we will meet up sometime and somewhere soon. Well, I thank all of you also for listening and tuning in. I hope that you got a lot out of this. I always enjoy getting listener feedback, and the best place to do that, of course, is if you use SpeakPipe, which is a little link that we have here on themagicwordpodcast.com. So if you just go to the website, you'll see that you can actually leave an audio comment there, and I will be posting that in the Magic Whisper. As I mentioned earlier, the Magic Whisper is the newest thing that I have added, which will be a short video of upcoming guests and just a lot of other stuff, but encapsulated in such a short time. And I promise to not talk as much as I normally do. Well, listen, this week there were a lot of glaring errors that I need to make right in this episode, because I know that I'm going to be getting some comments back from you saying, hey, this wasn't this or wasn't that. One thing we did talk about briefly was about the football team, and I mentioned about it being Hertz. Actually, it was Watford, which I think is within Hertz. I think Hertz is the larger area, and Watford is within that, because that was where Terry Seabrook lived, was Watford, and that's the name of the football team there. And another thing that I kept saying in error, and Richard didn't correct me, and he was so nice not to do that, although I kind of wish he would have, and that is the name of his podcast. It's called Richard Wiseman's On Your Mind, not On My Mind, but On Your Mind. So it's Richard Wiseman's On Your Mind. Be sure to look for that on iTunes or wherever that you get your podcast. Another thing is, as we were talking about, or I just happened to mention a book about what everybody is saying, that's everybody is saying, I mentioned who was an FBI profiler who wrote this book. And I was referring to him as Joe Natero. That's a completely different gentleman. In fact, I think he was one who was part of the Houdini seance, which we talked about then later. But actually, the gentleman's name who wrote the book was Joe Navarro. You can see how I kind of got that mixed up. Anyhow, Joe Navarro, and I suggest if you're interested in that kind of a thing, you can go and check that out. And the other thing, and finally, was the lady or the tiger that I mentioned. I think I said the woman or the tiger. The story was actually the lady or the tiger. It's not the woman or tiger. And it was not O. Henry, but it was Frank R. Stockton. And that is, a short story in which you're having to make a choice. You have two doors, and you're choosing one on the left or the right, and one has a lady behind it, another one has a tiger who's going to eat you up and kill you. So anyhow, interesting dilemma, which you choose and why you would choose which one. That's the short story I was referring to. So that was by Frank Stockton. So enough of that. Sorry for those mistakes. Hopefully I clarified all those for all of you. And I hope that you continue to listen despite my errors from time to time and my omissions. And if you've got some suggestions that you can give me about how that I can improve this podcast and perhaps correct some other errors I may have made in the past, please do so. And you can send that to me, and also suggestions for upcoming guests. And I'm starting to get those in already who have watched the video that's over on YouTube then right now that is the Magic Whisper. It's starting to get some traction here already. So I'm going to read the viewer email or viewer text that I get. And also I will post the sound bites from SpeakPipe if you use that as well. Okay, this has run a little bit long. I do want to mention one last thing, and I said up front that Richard is going to offer two copies of his book, Magic Your Mind Happy, and he will sign that and mail it to you postpaid wherever you are in the world. I started to say United States, it doesn't matter. He's going to do that. Well, what a great guy, and what a great offer. So if you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com this week and just put in your name and email address, your name could be one of the two random names selected, and he will get that out to you. So please enter. I don't say enter often. In fact, I say enter once. Please just put your name in one time, because one entry only. Even if you have different email addresses, please. So this way that everyone has an opportunity if we just have one entry per person. It doesn't matter what email you use, just one per person. Aside from that, I think I need to wrap this up. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to make it as good as possible for the next generation. Because it's up to us to create magic to pass on to that next generation. This is Scotty out.